Big round of applause for Jay from Greenville.
Thank you, Lou. An introduction like that reminds me of this sign I saw, and it was outside a church, and it said, annual strawberry festival, but due to the recession, we'll be serving prunes. And so I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jay Kimball.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, everybody. I've been sober by the grace of a loving God, extremely strong sponsorship, and because I'm an active member of a home group since October the 12th of 2003. That home group's the traditional group. We meet on Tuesday and Friday nights at 8 o'clock in Greenville, South Carolina. And if you're ever up there, we'd love to have you come visit with us. I want to thank Jay and the committee for inviting Kimberly and I down. And this is a convention that we come to regularly. And you guys do a tremendous job. And everything's just been fantastic. And I'm looking forward to a real good weekend. So we appreciate you having us. When I first started to come around Alcoholics Anonymous, I used to hang around at a lot of open discussion meetings. I don't do that much anymore, but I used to. And there was a group of old guys, and they'd sit in the back and they'd say, "Stick around, kid, you'll get your life back." And man, I never liked that. I didn't want my life back. And thanks to good sponsorship, the doctor's opinion talks about the message that must hold us alcoholics has to have depth and weight. And it talks about if I'll ground my ideals in a power greater than myself, I'll recreate my life. And that's something completely different than getting my life back. Page 29 of the big book talks about clear-cut directions. And the first direction it gives right after that is what I think I'm supposed to do tonight. And basically what it says is that I'm supposed to tell you in my own words and from my own point of view how I formed my relationship with God. And I'm going to try to do that. I'm going to tell you a little story that might explain my relationship with God before I got here. It's about this guy, and he was in a parking lot, and he couldn't find a parking space. He was late, had to be in court, and he just stopped the car, and he looked up, and he said, "God, I got to get in this courthouse. If you'll just help me, I'll go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll be nice to that wife, and I'll get a job, and I'll do right." And when he opened his eyes, there was a parking space. And he said, "Never mind, I found one." And that's the kind of the way I was before I got here. I grew up in a home with good parents. They never missed a PTA meeting. They never missed a baseball practice. They provided for me really well. But, I guess the two most important things that happened to me when I was a kid happened when I was about 7 years old. And the first thing that happened was I had a younger brother that was born. And I never was one of these kids who felt like the attention was taken from the younger child. You know, we remained close, and we've always remained close. But it was about that time, too, that my parents set me down and I know that they did it in a loving and caring way because that's the kind of parents they were. But they told me that my father loved me and my mother so much when he met her that he adopted me. And, an interesting thing, I have an interesting thing that happens to me. Maybe it happens to you. I don't always hear what people tell me. And what I heard was there's something wrong with you. And now I don't know how much of that I processed at 7 years old, but I knew I immediately felt different. And I immediately began to be filled with this hate and this rage that I didn't know where it came from. And, it wasn't long after that I started to realize that there were some things different about my house. And it was my father's drinking. And I'm going to talk to you some tonight about my relationship with my father. It's important for me to tell you that I do that with his permission. It's a little more important for me to tell you that tonight since he's sitting out in the crowd somewhere. But, I was filled with all that hate and that anger, and I didn't know where it came from. And I began to lie, and I began to find things that the neighborhood kids lost before they lost them. And I was just a rotten kid, and I used the situations at my house to make people feel sorry for me, and I manipulated situations and I manipulated people, and I did all this in an effort to make myself feel better. One of the things I swore, though, is I swore that I was never going to drink because I hated my father. I hated the way he was. I hated the things that happened in my home. I hated to have to hold that six-year-old little boy in between my legs at night when things were breaking and they were screaming and say, "It's okay. I'm not going to let him hurt you." I just hated that, and I swore I was never going to do that to anybody. But, you know, when I got to be about 15 years old, all my buddies were starting to drink. Now, I'm a follower. It's important for me to tell you that. I watched what you do, and I did it so fast, it looked like we're doing it at the same time. So one of the things that I did, my buddies were drinking, and we decided one day that we went across the tracks to the wrong side of town, so to speak, and we were hanging around this gas station, and we were trying to get folks to buy some wine, and we're having a hard time. I wasn't bald back then. I was about 15 years old. But by this time, I'd learned to manipulate anything. I mean, I could manipulate any situation. And there's this old guy walking around in an army coat with a gas can. And he's trying to get people to fill that gas can up. Nobody will do it. So I studied this situation. And the guy's name was High Test. And he huffed gasoline fumes out of that gas can. And they knew him around there and just wanted to run him off. And so I said, "Hey, man, I'll fill the gas can up. They'll think I'm a kid cutting grass locally around here. You get some wine, and I'll meet you out back." And I was to find out at 15 years old the kind of places alcohol was going to take me for the next 15 years. By 5 o'clock that afternoon, I was behind that gas station huffing gasoline fumes with that guy drinking wine. And never got much better than that. I never was much of a student, but I drank that wine and took a couple pulls off that gas can, and I breezed right through high school. 4 years, 3 summer schools. I got in a lot of trouble where alcohol was concerned right off the bat. I lost my driver's license not long after I got it for underage possession of alcohol, and ended up in some kind of outpatient counseling for alcoholism. And I know that sometime in high school I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't remember anything about any of the AA meetings I went to there other than one day I was sitting in there and Mr. Black came walking in, and Mr. Black was my shop teacher, and his eyes got about as big as my eyes got, and I don't know if I ever went back to another meeting, but somehow I managed to finish high school and get the opportunity to go to Lewisburg, North Carolina, to a little junior college down there on a baseball, with an opportunity to play baseball. And, I got down there to Lewisburg, and it was a little Methodist college, and it was, you know, there was like a Walmart and a Hardee's. And, I had grown up in Northern Virginia right outside of Washington, D.C., so I was like used to the city, and here I am, Walmart and a Hardee's, Methodist, you know, I just was. And, I drank up that opportunity to play baseball in less than 3 months. I never saw the baseball field. Not during the day anyway. The baseball field set way down at the end of campus. We used to go down there in the dugout at night and drink. That's the only time I ever saw it. And I said some things to the dean one night that you shouldn't say to the dean at a Methodist school. And that was it. And back home I went. Now, this is kind of a recurring theme in my story. I went back home to Mom, and good alcoholic. I've met a lot of us that do that. And I did, and I went back home. But when I went back home, things were different. That younger brother that I had, all through school I had been Mr. Potential. If you would just apply yourself, if you would just work a little bit harder. You know, I had coaches say that and teachers. But I didn't care about any of that stuff. I didn't care about working harder. I used to have this counselor. Her name was Miss Roach, and she would always ask me, "Why do you do the things that you do?" And I would give her the typical alcoholic answer, I guess. I don't know. You know, but what I wanted to tell her was, if you knew the way I felt when I wasn't drinking, you'd never ask me that again. I just hated the way I felt, and I hated who I was becoming, and I hated the things I was doing, but I didn't know not how to do them. I got back home, and gosh, man, I guess I've had or been fired from more jobs than most people ever even apply for. You know, I'd work somewhere for a couple weeks and get a paycheck, and I wouldn't like that, and I'd quit. But that younger brother I had was, he was the student body president. He was the male athlete of the year. He was the MVP of the baseball team. He was all the things that I wanted to be, that they said I could be, that alcohol kept me from being. And, you know, that's a tough position to be in. You know, I would look at him and I would think to myself, why can't I be like that? And I would just drown it in more alcohol. And, you know, I was a blackout drinker, and I would black out, and there'd be this moment where I could hear and see, but like I couldn't walk and I couldn't talk. Like I just couldn't move. We were, just to give you an example, we were at a party one night out in the country, and we were coming home, and there was a deer on the side of the road. And we decided that it looked like it had just been hit, so we were going to just have some venison, pick it up, take it home. So we picked the deer up, we put it in the back of the truck, and we get back into town. And you got to kind of picture this. Officer Wolverton's house is on this corner, and my house is on this corner, and there's an entrance to the city park in between those two houses. And we get that deer in the light, and nobody was going to be eating any meat off of that deer, if you know what I mean. It was in bad shape. And so we just threw it in the bushes. We pulled up in the park and just threw it in the bushes. And now Officer Wolverton must have been looking out the window, because we didn't get two or three blocks down the road, and we were surrounded by the police. They had their guns drawn. And I'm laying in the back of this truck, and then I'm can't move and I can't talk, but I can feel them hitting my ankles with that big old flashlight. And I've known Officer Wolverton my whole life. I'm the kind of kid who got in a lot of trouble in the neighborhood, so we weren't strangers. And I remember this like it was yesterday. He said to my buddy Bobby, he said, you guys call yourself this boy's friends? He can have alcohol poisoning. And without missing a beat, Bobby said, he doesn't have alcohol poisoning. He's like that all the time. And, you know, and I just did things like that. And, you know, I never had been much of a ladies man. And, so I didn't have that deal kind of tying me down. And, you know, some of you older guys like Skip may remember a time when you could do cool stuff in America, like join the circus or ride the rails. It's like the Great American Adventure back then. And my Great American Adventure involved a 74 Volkswagen pop-top van and a summer on the road with the Grateful Dead. And I saw a lot of stuff on the road with the Grateful Dead. I'm not so sure it was all really there. But I packed everything I owned in that 74 Volkswagen van, and we hit the road. And we were on our way to New York City. We were coming from Columbia, South Carolina. We'd taken a detour. The Dead wasn't playing that night or something. We stopped at Farm Aid. And this Farm Aid was in Columbia, South Carolina. And we were selling grilled cheeses in the parking lot of Williams-Brice Stadium. And, you know, we left Columbia headed for New York City. And we got as far as Dunn, North Carolina, which is a little town outside of Fayetteville. And we stopped at a Stuckey's and a Hardee's in the same building. Now, I'm from the suburbs of Washington, D.C. I'd never seen anything like that. I was amazed. And it was just the strangest thing to me, but we were pumping gas in that van, and the engine in those things is in the back, and it caught on fire. And when the fire hit the gas we just put in it, it blew up. It exploded. It burnt to the ground. The only things left were some balloons, and you can figure out what those were for, and a Bob Dylan CD. And I think I still have that Bob Dylan CD, but here I am on the side of the road. I'm 20 years old. Everything I'd accumulated in my life was in that van. I had on a pair of cutoff shorts and a Jerry Garcia T-shirt and no shoes. And, you know, I called my mom, and I said, you're going to have to send me some money to come back home. And she did. You know, and I went back home, and nothing got better. You know, Dad had gone to treatment when I was in the eighth grade, and he'd gotten sober. And by the time I got back home, he was drinking again, and it got bad. And sometimes it would get violent, and sometimes it wouldn't. And it was about this time that I met a young lady, and she was going to fix me. She was responsible, but the deal was she was moving to West Palm Beach, Florida. Now, my parents afforded me every opportunity in the world to succeed, and I found an art school down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida that accepted me. I can't draw. I can't color. I can't paint. I got a 3-year-old. I'm just not artistically talented. I don't know how I got into that school, but nevertheless I did. And I hold to the fact that alcoholism is a family disease, and I can probably give you some examples of that. And the first one is that my parents loaded up everything, and they took me down to Fort Lauderdale, and they went to that school, and they paid the bills at the school. And then we went over to the apartment complex, and they paid the bills at the apartment complex. And then they went to the bank, and they gave me a checking account and a checkbook, and they both hugged me, and they both said, "Son, we love you, and we know you're going to do good." And we left that school, and they left, and I never went back. I rode that as long as you can ride it. They started calling six or 7 months later looking for report cards, and I didn't have any of that stuff. But what had happened to me while I was in Florida was the things that I did, the things that I saw in that house that I swore I'd never do, I began to do those things to that young lady. And I can remember waking up, and my roommate's there, and there's a hole in the wall, and there's broken glass, and he's looking at me, but I don't remember. I don't remember anything. But he's got that look, and he says, "What's wrong with you? You spit in her face last night." And I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I know I can't stop. I hope I never have to feel what it feels like to try to apologize for something you don't remember doing ever again. I somehow convinced her to come back to Virginia with me. And we went back to my parents' house, and we rocked along doing that for a while, and I wouldn't work. I would just lay around drunk in my room and just cause problems and get in trouble with the law and just despicable things that I would do when I was drinking. And sometimes I might be the life of the party, and then I might spit in your face, those kind of things. And I left one New Year's Eve, and I just left her, and that's what I do, just kind of like the tornado. I'd mess it up, and then I leave, and it's your problem. You can fix it, because I don't care, because when I'm gone, it's not my problem anymore. And and she left, and she was gone, and I started to spend a lot of time in Southeast Washington, D.C., and it was on one of those days that I let a guy stick a needle in my arm. And I'm not here tonight to tell you that story. There's a reason that I even bring it up. But from that day, it wasn't 3 months that I was living on Skid Row, Southeast Washington, D.C., on 3rd Street in an abandoned house. And if you've ever lived on the streets, I don't really need to go into the details of that. I just did all the things that you do when you live on the streets. And the main thing I did is I became a criminal. I learned how to become a criminal. Here's the young boy with all the potential who's, was the Episcopal acolyte and whose parents provided him all these opportunities to succeed. And I'm on the streets digging in trash cans and just doing whatever it is I have to do to survive. And my mother would come down there at night sometimes looking for a little boy. And sometimes she would find me and sometimes she wouldn't. And, I had a friend of mine who had grew up down the street, 5 houses down the street from me. And he'd moved out to Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and he was out there coaching high school basketball, and he found out about my situation. He called my mom. My parents were getting ready to move back to Greenville, South Carolina. My dad had just retired from his job, and my brother was going off to Virginia Tech University, so, it sounded like a good idea to me. I don't know if any of you ever been to Steamboat Springs, Colorado. I'd never been there, but I saw some pictures, and I was, living on Skid Row. Steamboat Springs is a heck of a lot prettier than Skid Row. And but I had to get detoxed, and that was a tough deal. And I got detoxed, and alcoholism, the family disease, kicked in again. This time they bought me a brand new car. They gave me another checkbook, and they sent me to Steamboat Springs, Colorado. And they didn't have any of that poison out there, at least not that I could find. I looked, but they had vodka, and I tried to drink all of it. I left a bar one night in that brand new car, and I heard a loud crash, and I felt something hit me in the face. And when I realized it was the airbag, I wrestled it down, and the car was still running. And there's like two cops in Steamboat. I mean, there's like 600 people in that town or something when it's not ski season. So the car was running. I did probably what you would have done. If the car's running and nobody's around, I drove home. And, you know, it wasn't long after that. There was blue lights and sirens and all this commotion. And I was just drunk enough and dumb enough to walk out there to see what was going on. And, you know, the next thing you know, I'm handcuffed and, you know, I was at a wedding not long ago in D.C., and the guy who put my shoes on me that night while I was handcuffed was telling Kimberly the story. And I, you know, he put my shoes on me while I was handcuffed, my roommate, and they took me to jail. And, you know, 3 or 4 days went by, and Mom wouldn't answer my phone calls. And Mom and Dad were going through a divorce, and Dad was drinking again. And I thought, well, if I can get my drunk dad on the phone, he'll understand. He'll send some money out here to get me out of jail. And finally I did. I got him on the phone, and he sent the money, and I got out. And my roommate came and picked me up, and he threw the newspaper on my lap. And the front page of the Steamboat Springs Inquirer, or whatever it was called, said, "Oil trail leads police to drunk driver." I had busted that oil pan in that accident. They'd followed it into this apartment complex, and I guess if I'd have stayed in the house, I wouldn't have got caught, but... If you're the high school basketball coach and your roommate's the oil trail guy, that doesn't work out too well in a small town like that. So, you know, needless to say, he asked me to leave, and I did. I went back to Greenville, South Carolina. My parents were there, and like I said, they were going through a divorce, and I didn't want to be a part of that. I'd been to Greenville before because my whole family was from there, but, you know, I kind of fancied myself a city boy, and... Man, they like NASCAR and fishing and hunting, and I didn't like any of that stuff. I liked Skid Row and liquor and winos and, you know. So I had a friend of mine call me, and he said his mother was a secretary where my father had worked in D.C. growing up. He called me, and he said, "Hey, man, I'm down here at Coastal Carolina University, and my parents have bought this condo down here in Surfside." And he said, "I got an extra room. Why don't you just come down? They pay the bills. We won't even tell them you're living here." And man, I said, "Bruce, I'll be there in 2 days. But you're going to have to come get me because I don't have a driver's license." And he came to Greenville and picked me up. And I came down here to Myrtle Beach and got a job up at Broadway at the beach at Joe's Crab Shack, bartending. And, got a doctor down in Georgetown because I had bad back problems from that accident. And, you know, I can remember I was at work one night and I was in his car with no driver's license, and he called me, and I'd been working, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. And he called and he said, "I meant to tell you, man, please don't drink and drive in that car. That car's still in my mom's name." And I said, "Man, how long have we known each other? I wouldn't do that." Now, I'd been behind that bar for 4 hours. Ain't no telling how drunk I was already. But that's the last thing I remember till the next morning when I woke up in Horry County Regional Medical Center with 3 broken ribs and a fractured bone in my face and a blood alcohol level of 0.29 at 7:30 in the morning. And I don't have any idea where I was going or where I was coming from. And they took me to that car to get my golf clubs out, and it was the first time in my life I'd ever been scared of what alcohol could do to me. That car looked like one of those cars they set outside of a high school at prom time to keep kids from drinking and driving. And I was scared till I got to the pharmacy and filled that prescription they gave me and went to the liquor, you know, to the beer aisle and got some beer. And interesting thing happened. I called my mom. She'd been on me about getting a job. And I said, "Mom, I need $500. And she said, "Well, I'm not going to be able to help you this time, son." That had never happened in 24 years, never. I never had to ask more than once usually. I said, "Look, you've been on me about getting this job. I got this job at this nice restaurant. I got to have black pants and black shoes and a white shirt, and I need $500. I got to have 2 outfits. I'm not going to be able to help you this time, son." "Well, I can probably get by on $250. "Well, son, I'm taking care of myself now. I'm a member of Al-Anon. You're going to have to take care of yourself." Now, I don't know who those Al-Anons are, but I'm going to Greenville to find out. I can tell you that. And the solicitor in Myrtle Beach, he had the idea that I was going to spend 30 days in jail or 30 days in this treatment center that Mom had picked out. You know, Al-Anons are funny that way. She'd had it all lined up. All I had to be detoxed, though. So they come get me, her and my aunt. I had this aunt who was like a mother to me, and they come pick me up, and they run me back up the road to Greenville to detox, and here we go off, and I'm asking, where is this treatment center? Well, it's in Mayberry, North Carolina. Mayberry, North Carolina? That's like the Andy Griffith Show, right? Like, that's not even a real place. And I can assure you that it is. They got Floyd's Barbershop and all that stuff up there. But, you know, we get in the car and we're headed to Mayberry, Mount Airy. And my dad had always told me I needed to be in some kind of sales. And I did the best selling job I'd ever done in my life up until that point between Greenville, South Carolina and Charlotte, North Carolina. By the time I got to Charlotte, I had a bus ticket and was dropped off at the Greyhound bus station. See, going to treatment scared me to death. I got on that Greyhound bus and I went back to Washington, D.C. to Skid Row because that didn't scare me. And that court date got a little bit closer, though, and jail scared me. And I don't know why I had the treatment center's phone number, but I did, and I called down there and I got a lady named Carol on the phone, and I had always been able to manipulate women. And I got Carol on the phone, and by the time I hung up, I was crying and begging, please, can I come back? You know, please, can I come? And they let me come, and, you know, I got there, and walking up to the porch, if any of y'all have ever been there, I'm walking up to the porch, and there's this little old man sitting on the porch, and he's got this box, and he sounds like Darth Vader. Scared me to death. I was scared. And, I stayed scared of that guy for a week or so, man, but that old man taught me a lot about love, and he taught me as much as I'd let him teach me about the disease, alcoholism. And, you know, I was in that treatment center. It seems like I was there about 7 days. And I was in one of those meetings, and they read How It Works. And they got to that line where they say, we beg you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And I disqualified myself from Alcoholics Anonymous because I was scared to death. And but I needed a letter for this judge down here, and so I did what they asked me to do, and I got the letter. And but you know, Mr. B did a great thing for me. He sent me back to Greenville, South Carolina, to what's still today my home group, to another old man who'd been sober longer than I'd been alive. And the old man was waiting on me when I got to the door, and he put his arm around me. He said, "I've been waiting on you." And he walked me up to the front row of our home group, and he set me down. And he said, "This is where you sit. You keep your mouth shut." And, you know, I spent the next 4 years doing everything he told me not to do, except sit on the front row. He would say, "Leave that girl alone, Jay. She's trying to get sober." And I'd go sit right next to her. Say, "Hey, how are you?" You know, or whatever. And, you know, and I came to the meetings drunk, and, it was just terrible. You know, I ended up living in this little apartment. This room is what it was. The bed folded up into the wall. And but, you know, there was a church next door. And those Al-Anons met in that church. They met on Friday nights. And it was a Friday night. And I'd had just enough. It was one of those been awake 3 or 4 day Friday nights. You know, been up all week. But I had just enough courage to finally go over there and tell them. Because I knew what they did is on Fridays they sat over there and they told my mom, "Don't give him any more money. Don't let that boy come home. Don't answer the phone. If the police are looking for him, just call him. Tell him where he is." I knew that's what they did. And I was just tired of it. And I was going over there to tell them. And I jumped the fence, and I stormed in the back doors of that church. And the room was full, and there was a guy at the podium dressed like I am tonight, and it was Monday night. And that's when the AA speaker meeting was, on Mondays. And I don't know if you've ever been drunk in the back of an AA speaker meeting, and they all turn around, and you're like a deer in headlights back there. And I'd been a nuisance around Greenville AA for a while, so I knew a lot of people, and I tapped this guy that I knew named Richard on the shoulder. When you're in that situation, you got to ask for help, at least to get out of it, whether you want it or not. I said, "Richard, man, I need some help. I can't stop drinking." And he came outside, and he said, "Well, why don't I go in here and get Bob, and we'll come over and flush that garbage down the toilet, pour all that vodka out, and we'll take you to detox." And I thought, man, here we go, another drastic proposal from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, everything y'all wanted me to do seemed so outrageous. And I looked at my watch, and it was about 8:15. And I said, "Richard, you probably need to be in that meeting." I said, "So why don't you go back in there, and you'd come over at 9, and I'll just have all that stuff gone. Won't throw anything away." Well, they never came. And but, you know, page 30 of this book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And I'm going to give you my definition of that. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. I've been awake for God knows how long. I got a big jug of grape Kool-Aid and a big bottle of Gilby's vodka. And I got to get a drink down. But when I chug it down, it hits my stomach and I throw it up. And I chug it again. It hits my stomach and I throw it up. And I take one of those needles I was telling you about and I start filling it up with that vodka. And I start shooting at my veins. And I can't stop. I cannot stop. I don't want to be the way I am, but I don't know how to stop. And, you know, I can remember living in that apartment and my mom would drive by there. And I spent a lot of time peeking out the windows. And I would see her. I would see her drive by. But she would never stop. You know, she told me later that she was scared to knock on the door because she's scared I was going to be dead. And, you know, I lived my life like that. I got into some trouble, something about stealing a lady's purse. And, I got caught and I went to jail. And I ended up in jail and, you know, I called my mom. And, you know, and by this time, active Al-Anon, every time I called her for something, she had some treatment center picked out. Like, already lined up, all the information, all the ducks in a row. I'll come help you, but that's the only help you're getting from me. And I wasn't going back to treatment. I'd already been to Hope Valley, and Mr. B taught me everything I need to know. I need to go back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a sponsor. I got a seat on the front row over there probably still. I don't need to go to treatment again. I need to go back to AA. I surely don't need to go to treatment for 6 months in the middle of nowhere in Georgia. And she would just hang up. "Well, when you're ready to go, call me back." You know, and it took 10 days. And I just couldn't take it anymore. And I said, "Come get me out of this jail. I'll go anywhere you want me to go." And, you know, they wouldn't even take me home. I mean, they wouldn't. The bus station trip taught them something, I think. They just wouldn't even. They just picked me up, pepperoni pizza in the car, change of clothes. Georgia. We turned onto what has got to be the longest dirt road in the Southeast, down in Louisville, Georgia. And we get out to this place, and I call it AA boot camp. It's called the Bridges of Hope, but you can't speak unless you're spoken to. You got to carry your big book with you everywhere you go. You got to sit with your back straight up and your feet flat on the floor. And if little Johnny's got 20 days and you got 18 days, little Johnny can tell you whatever he wants, and you got to do it. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. They line all the new guys up along the wall under 30 days when you eat. And you sit, all the guys who got more than 30 days are eating, and all the new guys are along the wall, and you got to sit there with your big book reading it. And they'd go, "Hey, boy," you know, something like 19-year-old little kid calling you that, "Hey, boy, what are the first 3 words on page 112? And you think you're going to do something fantastic, and you flip over there and read this book. Those are the first 3 words. They'd say, "Shut up, that's right, shut up and read." Man, I did, and I was facing a lot of time in prison. I'd been on probation when I got in all that trouble, and so I'll shut up and read rather than go to prison. I mean, I did that for 6 months. Every day I did that. I was drunk in 3 days when I left, and I was homeless, and I was living in this car that I had that I had borrowed the money from a guy in AA to get the car and not paid him back. And I had stolen a license plate off a car, off of a truck, from one of my grandfather's trucks. And I was living in this car, and it's wintertime, and it's cold. And my grandparents' business was here, and their house was right next door. And I would park that car in the morning, like 6:30 in the morning, out in front of my grandparents' house. Because I knew at 6:30 in the morning, my grandmother would be in the kitchen. She'd be making breakfast. She'd be reading the upper room. She'd look out that window. She'd see her favorite grandson out in that car. And she'd come out there. And I'd say, "What's wrong with your daughter?" "Grandmother, she won't let me come home." "Now, I know you raised her better than that. Can't you call her? I mean, it's cold out there. I don't have anywhere to go." You know, who does that? I did that. That's what alcohol does to me. And, you know, I did that for I don't know how long. One morning I couldn't take it anymore. And I called a guy named Arch. And I said, "Arch, I don't know what to do." And he said, "Well, I do." He said, "Why don't I come get you and we'll take you to an AA meeting." And Arch came and picked me up. And he took me to the meeting. And you know, you guys did the same thing you'd always done. You just hugged me and you welcomed me back. And you said it was going to be okay. And I started doing good. My family let me come to work for that company. And I got my own little place. And I was, you know, 90 days sober. And I'm on the front row at my home group. And she walks in. And I know she's looking at me. I can like feel her eyes in the back of my head. But I know what they're going to say. I know what they're going to say. So I don't even say anything. I just walk outside. There's this little bench outside our home group, and I go sit on that bench. And I think the daily reflection that morning had been about God's will or something. And I said, "I'm not going to talk to her, but if she comes over here, it must be God's will." And she did. She came over, and we started to talk, and she said, "Hi, my name's Kimberly." And I said, "Hi, my name's Jay." And she said, "You have beautiful eyes." And I told you, I don't always hear what people tell me. What I heard was, "Can I have your phone number?" So I wrote it down, and I gave it to her. And I don't know how long it was. A couple weeks went by. No, I didn't see her anywhere because I went to every AA meeting in Greenville looking for her. And she didn't call. Now, I'm a sensitive alcoholic. Now, I had bathed every day for 3 months. I had on clean clothes. You know, my feelings were hurt. And come to find out, she was in jail. So we're off to a good start. And, you know, she got out of jail. And, you know, I knew what they were going to say. And, you know, but there just comes a point where finally my sponsor was just like, "You know, just take it slow. You're not going to listen to me anyway, you know." And I did. I waited a couple weeks before I let her move in. And, you know, I was playing on an AA softball team at the time. And, man, it had been a long time since I got to, like, show off any athletic ability. So, well, first of all, I'd been thinking about drinking. Now, I moved her in. I'd never had anything of my own. And I'm 90 days sober, and I move her in, and now my bed is our bed. And my living room's our living room, and I didn't like that. And I was ready to drink and get out of there. But my ego was big enough that I wanted to go to the AA softball game and show off before I left. And so she could know what she was missing once I was gone. And So we get down to the AA softball game, and I'm in the batter's box, and I hear all this commotion going on, and I look over, and they're taking her up the hill in handcuffs. And I thought right then, I might just marry that girl. I mean, hey, when I drink, I get handcuffed. You got to have somebody who understands that kind of thing. It was a misunderstanding, and Kimberly got out of jail. And you know, it wasn't long, and we were on probation, and it wasn't long till It wasn't long till we both were drunk, and we were in violation of our probation, and we got thrown out of that apartment, and we were on the run, and you know, I got a phone call one day from my mom, and she said, "I don't care where you are or what kind of shape you're in, but Donna's passed away." Some of y'all may have known Donna, and she said, "That old man and Donna love you, and you get to that mortuary." And I was drunk, and I got in a cab, and I took a cab to that mortuary. And I walked in the front doors of that mortuary, and with his wife of 25 years in the casket in the next room, when the old man saw me, he put his arms around me, and he took me off to the side, and he talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I left that mortuary, I wanted to be like that old man so bad. So bad. See, I always wanted what you had in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wasn't willing to do what you did to get it. And, you know, Kimberly and I left. We had to leave Greenville. The heat was on. And Mom was, you know, I was just convinced that she was looking for the cops so she could call them and tell them where I was. And she'd had to try to have me committed. Now, I didn't even know you could do that to somebody. But they take me over to this hospital, and they interview me. And it's like a commitment, I guess. If you fail the interview, they just lock you up in some hospital or something. Second best-selling job I'd ever done in my life up until that point. I asked this doctor if he'd ever heard of Al-Anon, and he said that he had. And I said, "Well, she's a member of that outfit, and she's been quit going to her meetings, and she's gone crazy." I said, "She's the one with the problem, not me. You got to let me go. I just can't." And he did. He cut me loose. And you talk about, me and Sterl were talking about that at intergroup the other day. She's mad as fire that day, boy. And Kimberly and I were on the run, and we ended up in a Skid Row hotel room in Columbia, South Carolina. And we were in that little 15 by 15 hotel room or whatever it was. And I can remember being in that hotel room with a young lady that I love more than anything in the world and never feeling so alone in my whole life. I was just consumed with fear and ashamed. And I knew that there was a better way, but I couldn't force myself to do what you guys did. See, I would come here and I'd want everything to just be given to me. I didn't want to work for anything. And Kimberly had this bright idea to go back up to Greenville, make some money. Sounded like a bad idea to me. The cops were looking for us, and my mom was looking for me, I know, to call the cops. And I wasn't sure. AA might have been looking for us. I didn't know. And but we get back to Greenville, and Kimberly... Kimberly did this deal, and it went wrong, and the cops came, and, you know, Kimberly got arrested, and I got away. I just ran. We had made this deal that if, you know, one of us gets caught, we need to just, don't make no sense for both of us to be in jail. We can't get the other one out. So I just ran. And, you know, I ended up in a treatment center, and, down in Columbia, South Carolina, and, you know, I guess it seemed like, I don't know how long I was there, maybe 7 or 10 days again, and they read that line again: "We beg you to be fearless and thorough from the very start." In the foreword to the second edition, it talks about when Bill's in the hotel, and he has the thought that he needs to carry this message to another alcoholic. And I've read this book, the first 164 pages, and done the work in it with a sponsor. And me and my sponsor discussed that part of that in length. And we talked about how God must have created that thought for Bill. And I'd like to share with you the thought God created for me that day in that treatment center when they read that line: "We beg you to be fearless and thorough from the very start." Rather than disqualifying myself from Alcoholics Anonymous like I'd always done, I heard the second part of that, "and thorough." I thought to myself right then, maybe I can't be fearless, but I can be thorough. From that moment to this moment, I've been thorough in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I found out is the more thorough I am, the more that fear is removed. You know, the first thing they made me do is call my probation officer and tell her where I was. And she said, well, that's good. You probably need to be there. How long is the treatment? And I said, 28 days. And she said, there'll be an officer there waiting on you. We'll be there to pick you up. And I had to figure out a way to accept the fact that my journey in sobriety was going to start in jail. And I did that. I'd been around long enough to know that there was chairs up there, and if they needed to be moved by God, I'd go up there and move them. And if something needed to be done, I just did it. I'd watched the people in my home group. I'd watched the people in Alcoholics Anonymous for all those years, even though I didn't listen to them. I watched what they did. And I did that. And sure enough, 28 days later, there was a couple cops there. And they handcuffed me and they shackled my feet. They were nice enough to handcuff me in the front. That's like a 100-mile drive in handcuffs. It wasn't very comfortable. And they took me to jail. And, I called my mom. And now, I hadn't called her for 30 days in treatment. And I hadn't called AA. And I hadn't called anybody. And I'd never done that before. I did what those people asked me to do at that treatment center when they asked me to do it exactly the way they asked me to do it. And I asked God every morning in that treatment center to help me stay sober. And I began to get these thoughts that maybe I could do this. Maybe I was going to be okay. And I also began to get these thoughts that if I didn't, that my life was going to be like this forever. This is the way it's going to be. And I called my mother that day and I told her that. And I said, I know that there's no reason in the world you should believe me or put any faith in anything I tell you. But I can't prove anything in this jail. Please get me out of here. Now, I wanted to get out. Make any bones about that. I did want to get out of jail. I didn't want to be in there. But, she did. She came and got me out. And she said, I'm done. This is your one shot. She let me spend one night at her house. She locked up everything that was worth any value. a friend of mine had made arrangements for me to interview with the halfway house the next day. And I did that. And I got into that halfway house and, I wanted to go back to work for that family business, but they wouldn't let me. And a few months went by and they let me go back. And, I was about 3 months sober and I got to face my first hardship in sobriety. That aunt that I told you about, who was like a mother to me, she got sick very suddenly and passed away. And I had to go to the hospital and I had to tell her, I had to say goodbye, and I went in that room, and I held her hand that night, and I said, Janie, it's Jay, and I just want you to know that I'm sober, and it's okay for you to go if you have to go, and one day at a time, I'm going to try to stay sober for you, and you guys have helped me do that. You've helped me keep that promise, and I walked out of that emergency room, and I looked up, and the little old nurse was a lady that I knew from the Alano Club in Greenville. She put her arms around my neck. She hugged me and she said, it's 10 o'clock and they got a meeting over at the club at 10:30 where they turn off all the lights and they light candles. Why don't you go over there, Jay? And I did. And, so as an example of doing the work and Alcoholics Anonymous being there, it was things like this that helped me to build that faith and that relationship with God that I was telling you about. And, it wasn't Kimberly got out of jail. And we decided that we were going to try to make it work. And, my story's not an endorsement for relationships early in sobriety. It's just what happened to me. And Kimberly lived in a homeless shelter when she got out of jail. And then she moved into a halfway house. And God, what an example of going to any lengths she was to me. And, she did whatever she had to do. And, we stayed away from each other for that first year or so. I mean, we were kind of together, but our home group breaks into four different meetings, and we would go to different meetings, and on the speaker meeting nights on Tuesdays, we didn't sit next to each other, and the meeting was for the meeting, and we were going to put God and AA first and not Jay and Kim first, and we've done that our whole time in sobriety. We've put God and AA first, and it's worked out. It's worked out. We rocked along in that first year of sobriety, and I can remember standing in that courtroom and 6 months sober and facing all those charges. It was time to pay the piper, and I was facing some prison time. And the judge just extended my probation. Well, man, I've been on the run from probation for so long, I had like 3 weeks left. And I mean, that was it. I paid him one more little time and probation was over. And, you know, I got a driver's license back. I failed the driving test 3 times. Not the written test either. Now, the driving 3-point turn, 3 times that 3-point turn got me. But you know, I got my driver's license back and I got in this big book and I began to take these steps. And I got to that inventory process and the spark, the fire was lit because I found out why. You know what I found out in the inventory? I found out why I did the things I did. And I found out that I didn't have to do them anymore. And, you know, Kimberly and I were a year sober and we got married. And it was an AA wedding and our families were there and our home groups were there. And I can remember Kimberly's grandfather putting his arm around me and saying, I couldn't be any prouder of the man that my husband has chosen, that my granddaughter has chosen to be her husband. 1 year in Alcoholics Anonymous. A year earlier, my mother had said, if you come to my house, I'm calling the police. And, you know, we got married and we celebrated a year sober all in the same week. And, you know, I celebrated that first AA anniversary. And the next day, Kimberly and I were in an Old Navy and we were shopping. And I got a phone call and it was that, you know, his voice was just hysterical on the other end of that line. And it was that father I told you I hated. And he said, son, I need you to tell me how you stay sober. And, you know, I called Sterl and I said, Dad needs some help. And I need to go out to Kentucky and talk to him. And he said, son, I know this is your father, but this is another alcoholic. And you need to make contact with Alcoholics Anonymous before you go out there. And I did. Got a hold of a guy named Patrick and a guy named Eddie, and we hooked up. And I went out there to visit Dad, and he wasn't doing so good. And the next time we went out, Kimberly came with me, and he still wasn't doing very well. And we left, and I was crying, and I said, God, Kimberly, I feel like there's something more I should be able to do. She said, Jay, all you can do is love him and be a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I set about trying to do that, and you know, it wasn't long after that that Kimberly and I, we had to go to the hospital. And Kimberly got cut from hip to hip. And all this screaming, and they handed me this little boy. And, you know, I was always taught that I got to live my way into good thinking. I couldn't think my way into good living. And I'd been taking the actions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I held that little boy And the first thought that came to my mind was just fear of, am I going to be a good father? What am I going to do? And it just went away that fast. See, because you all have taught me to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I'll do that, I'll automatically be a good father. And I'll be a good husband, and I'll be a good son. And, you know, we rocked along, and we got that baby home from the hospital. And I got a phone call, and it was my aunt from Kentucky. And she said, I hate to do this to you today. She said, but your father's in Baptist East Hospital with a blood alcohol level of 0.39 on suicide watch. And there's nothing I can do. I got that little baby and I can't go. But you see, because of good sponsorship, I was told to make contact with Alcoholics Anonymous all those months back. And I called Patrick. And I said, Patrick, man, I can't get out there, but Dad's in Baptist East. Patrick said, man, I'll go get Ezzy. Visiting hours are at 6:30 over there. I sponsored a guy who went through that place, and Patrick went over there for me. And, you know, that taught me right then how big Alcoholics Anonymous was and what this deal is really about. And, you know, I guess a couple weeks went by, and Dad called, and he said, you'll never guess what happened. A couple guys from AA showed up over here the other night. And you guys had taught me a little bit about ego at that point, and I said, isn't that great how God works in Alcoholics Anonymous? And that's kind of all I said. You know, and Dad went through treatment and he got sober. But Kimberly and I had left the house that day. And we were just driving around and I was upset. And my mom was going through a hard time then. And my brother was in that magical wonderland between college and responsibility. And my dad's on suicide watch. You know, and I told Kimberly, I just crying, and I said, she said, what's the matter with you? And I said, I just never thought I'd be the most responsible member of my family. And she looked at me with all the seriousness that a wife can look at a husband with, and she said, "Sweetheart, you're not the most responsible member of your family. I am." And you know, and I need that. I need that from time to time. But Dad got the opportunity to come to Greenville, and he got the opportunity to go with me to my home group, and he got the opportunity to go home and meet his grandson. And we were walking back to the car, and he was getting in his car, and he stopped for a minute. He turned around and looked at me, and he said, "Son, I just want you to know that I love you, and you're a good example of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you." And gosh, I can't tell you what that's meant to me. And it wasn't long after that that I got a phone call from Kentucky, and it was Dad, and he said, "I'm going to be celebrating a year sober in a couple weeks. I'd love for you to come out here and share your story with us." And we've got to do that at all his anniversaries, so that's been tremendous. I've got the opportunity since I've been sober to work with guys and to stay on the firing line, Alcoholics Anonymous, and be active and work with guys and see their lives change. And that Al-Anon mother who our relationship was so strained, she's at my house all the time now, you know. I know there hadn't been a day in 5 years that she's driven by my house and been scared to knock on the door. Not one day. And I'm in a business now. I was able to leave that family business, and that family business are customers of mine. So I get to deal with her on a work basis and on a motherly basis, and that's a struggle sometimes. But I'm able to do that. And last December, Kimberly went to the hospital, and they cut her again from hip to hip, and this time they handed me a little girl. And it was my 33rd birthday. And I guess God doesn't want me to forget that little girl's birthday. And Kimberly talked the other night, and she talked about holding that little girl and looking at her and thinking if she ever grew up to be like her, she'd kill her. I was thinking about that. If that little girl grows up to be half the woman her mother is, she'll be lucky. She'll be lucky. I have the Serenity Prayer on a little plaque, or on a little banner that somebody gave me, this fancy thing hanging next to my bed. And Kearns asked, my son asked me what it was, and I told him it was the Serenity Prayer, and he calls it the Senenity Prayer. But we've gotten to do that. And, you know, he likes to pretend. And sometimes he's Mr. Clark. Mr. Clark's the guy who cuts my grass, and I sponsor another guy named Big Todd, big guy, and Big Todd parks in front of the house in the same spot every time he comes over to read or go through the book. And Kearns has this little car, and sometimes he parks there and gets out, and he's Big Todd. And Kimberly called me the other day, and she said, "You know, your son's in here on the couch on his knees with his hands folded." And I asked him what he was doing, and he said, "I'm Daddy, I'm praying." It's such an amazing ride. It's such an amazing deal to get to see those kids and to know that that as long as I stick close to you guys and do what you guys do, that they don't ever have to see me drink. And I'm going to tell you a story about an amend I got to make to my grandfather. It was one of the best amends that I got to make, the most rewarding. And there was a number of years back where he had been the mayor of a little town up outside of Greenville for a number of years. And I got in a lot of trouble in that town one day. And they took me in front of this judge, and my grandfather was in there. And my grandfather told that judge, he said, "If you'll let him go, and you'll let him, I'll put him to work, and how he'll make this right." Now, what I heard was, if you let him go, he's going to leave town, and I'll make it right for him. And that's what I did. It was a year or so ago, and that business that he ran got in some trouble because of some things somebody else did. And he was in some trouble with the IRS. I was able to, there was something that was important, very important to him and my grandmother that they thought they were going to lose. And Kimberly and I were able to write him a check for it, put it in our name, and give it back to him. And it talks about direct amends, and because I can write a check, I don't think that's direct amends. But I went to him when I handed him that check, and we had a long talk, and I told him the kind of person I had been and the things that I had done, and that I wasn't trying to be that way anymore, and that I wanted him to have this gift from me for all the things that he had done for our family and for me. And he looked at me with tears in his eyes, and he said, "I want you to know that you're one of the only people I can trust. That's what you all have done. You've given an 87-year-old grandfather a grandson he can trust. You've given me a relationship with my mother, a relationship with my father. You've given my brother, an older brother he can look up to. You've given my children a father and my wife a husband. But I'll tell you the greatest thing Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me and continues to do. You take a guy who hated who he was when he got here and where he'd been, and you've taught me and continue to teach me that it took exactly who I was and where I've been to make me what I am tonight. And I tell you what I am tonight's an alcoholic who's recreating his life right here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want to thank you for letting me share it with you."
Thank you, Jay. On behalf of the committee, we'd like